Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our docket to be orally argued this afternoon, and I understand that counsel have checked in and given the clerk the time that they would like to argue, so if you will call the first case, we will begin.
Court will now call Karamo Darion Ellison, Thomas S. Byrd, LGD, AKA, FKA, Thomas S. Byrd, Incorporated. May it please the court, Mr. D. Michael Wallace will argue for the appellant. Mr. J. James Knopf will argue for the appellate.
Hey, please, the court, counsel, good afternoon. I'm Michael Wallach. I represent Mr. DeLeon, the appellant. This court is very familiar with the procedural background of this case, as I'm sure that everyone will remember after having read the briefs and the record, is that on the first time up, this case was on appeal from a motion for summary judgment. Mr. DeLeon was the general employee of Sparkling Clean Pressure Wash, which was a subcontractor to Thomas S. Byrd, the general contractor on the job site in question. At that point in time, the issue was whether or not Thomas S. Byrd owed Mr. DeLeon a duty under the law as the general contractor. The trial court had granted summary judgment on no duty, and it was the position of Mr. DeLeon that because Thomas S. Byrd had retained control. At that time, there was the discussion was both actual control as well as contractual control. It thereby owed a duty under Section 414 of the Restatement Second of Torts, as well as various Texas Supreme Court cases which have enacted that section of the Restatement of Torts. This court held as a matter of law that the subcontract between Thomas S. Byrd and Sparkling Clean Pressure Wash provided for retained control of the details of the work of Sparkling Clean Pressure Wash, and therefore under the Koch case as well as other cases, that it owed a duty of reasonable or ordinary care in the retained control which it had under the subcontract. The case was reversed and remanded for trial. Trial took place, and at the trial it was the contention that Thomas S. Byrd, number one, owed a duty under Section 414 as established by this court on the appeal from the summary judgment. But the standard which this court utilized in finding the existence of that duty as a matter of law under the contract was the retained control by Thomas S. Byrd of Sparkling Clean's duties with respect to certain matters under the contract. That test, which the court obtained from the Koch case, in which the court noted was that from the first DeLeon 1, the court stated that instead, Byrd at its discretion could substitute labor, materials, and equipment for those of Sparkling Clean if Byrd determined them insufficient. This provision essentially gave Byrd the right and discretion to control the means, methods, and details of Sparkling Clean's work to the extent that Sparkling Clean was not entirely free to do its work its own way. By doing so, by utilizing this language, which the Supreme Court promulgated in the Koch case, and which the court found the contract provided in this case, we now shift into traditional master-servant and borrowed-servant territory. Because the test is the same, as the court laid out in great detail, the Supreme Court laid out in great detail in St. Joseph versus Wolfe. The supreme test for master servant and for borrowed servant, whichever the circumstances address, it is the right to direct and control the means, methods, and details of the work. If you have that right, then you are the master of that person, whether you call them the servant or the borrowed servant. Taking those legal principles, the plaintiff, Mr. DeLeon, pleaded in the trial court that Thomas S. Byrd had retained, by virtue of the contract and by virtue of this court's holding, the control of the means, methods, and details of the work which caused his injury. That being the case, those being the operative facts and operative details we brought into play, for purposes of the trial, concepts of master-servant, borrowed servant, as well as the control and the duty under Section 414 of the Restatement Second of Torts. This concept that control transcends each of these areas is brought out, number one, by this court's holding in the Morris versus JTM leasing case. That was a truck accident case. The plaintiff sued the truck owner, the truck lessor, and the driver. In looking at the issue, in that case, the trial court had granted summary judgment on a variety of issues, one of which was JTM, who was the lessee of the truck. Their contract provided that they would have full operational control of the truck, even though their employee wasn't driving it, and that it wasn't their load being hauled. This court, utilizing common law principles, citing first to the Lee Lewis versus Harrison case, which is a Section 414 of the Restatement case, Restatement of the Law case, said that that principle is what we look to determine vicarious liability. In that case, the driver wasn't the employee of JTM, but because JTM had operational control, that flowed through on a vicarious liability standard, and the summary judgment should be reversed because there was the contractual control which had been retained. And in legal research being what it is, Your Honors, I discovered one other case which was fairly recent, and I would, with the court's permission, bring to the court's attention the case of White versus DR and PA Deliverance Limited, 2014 Westlaw 767218, First District of Houston, decided February 25, 2014. And like this court in the JTM case, the question was whether or not there was vicarious liability by a contractor for a subcontractor. And the court noted that the right to control the details of the work is the supreme test for whether a master-servant relationship exists and whether the rule of vicarious liability applies, citing the Golden Spread versus Boy Scouts case. In Koch, cites to the Koch holding, which this court also cited to in De Leon 1, and noted that only if the employer controls the details and methods of the independent contractor's work to such an extent that the contractor cannot perform the work as he so chooses, again, the same rationale which this court utilized. In that case, the court found no sufficient control, but the principles which this court followed in Morris, they followed in this case as well.
Well, what was the citation? 2014 Westlaw what?
767218.
Thank you.
And so far I didn't find any evidence of a petition for review being filed, but it's still early. This court, having established the standard on right to control and having determined that as a matter of law the right to control existed under this contract, that became the law of the case. So when we go back to trial the second time, again, the issues being the right to control the details of the work in question, that's already been decided. The legal effect of that's already been decided from De Leon 1. So it applies, that's about as same as it gets going from one case to the next.
Well, the only difference. We also decide in De Leon 1 that that the Sparkling Clean was an independent contractor?
As a general principle, Sparkling Clean was an independent contractor.
And so it's your position that all you have to do is factually plead the right to, or the retention of control, and you don't have to plead for master servant or borrowed servant or vicarious liability or any, you don't have to plead any of that?
I think in the absence of special exceptions with the pleadings, what you're required to plead are the operative facts. And once you plead the operative facts, the legal basis for recovery are taken from that, and you're not required to plead the legal basis in the absence of special exceptions.
Well, if that's the case, then you'd never have to. All you ever have to do is file a pleading that stated your facts, and you'd never have to list your causes of action.
I think in the absence of special exceptions, the causes of action which would flow from those, that would be true. In particular, in this case, though, we pleaded that the control was with Thomas S. Byrne on those matters which this court found to be subject to the control. Then we alleged that Byrne was responsible. So that would be sufficient, number one, to put a lawyer on notice, which is the test, is that we're claiming allegations of control. Allegations of control go to vicarious liability, whether it's bond servant or master servant, as well as their own obligations under Section 414, which this court had decided. So within the broad pleading which was there, both factually as well as legally, the control issues laid out the basis for supporting vicarious liability as well as master-servant relationship, and also the fact that Byrne was responsible for those injuries. In particular, we pleaded that Byrne had a duty to provide a safe place to work, and the only people who owe a safe place to work for employees are employers. So that in and of itself leads you to the conclusion, or certainly in the direction, certainly on notice of, that they're alleging a master-servant relationship in part based upon those facts. Again, in the absence of special exceptions, all inferences are given toward the benefit of the pleader. And in this case, there were no special exceptions. So that gets us to the barred servant issue. Again, if the right to control exists, the right to control Sparkling Clean's employees exist, then that makes them the borrowed servants of Thomas S. Byrne with respect to those matters, not all matters, not generally, but with respect to those matters over which they have the right to direct and control the details, methods, and manner of the work. Then that makes them the borrowed servants or servants, depending on, again, which categorization you choose to use. But with that being the case, and in this case we contend as a matter of law that was the case, then contributory negligence and comparative causation is not a defense, and it should not have been submitted in question 1 and 2. And that is harmful error because, as the court can readily see, the jury put 25% of the fault on Thomas S. Byrne, and if you take away the 75% fault that was assessed to Mr. DeLeon, the way the charge was submitted, then there's clearly harm with respect to the result which was obtained. The next two issues deal with the court's charge. Question 1 and 2, as submitted by the court, just asked about Thomas S. Byrne and DeLeon, without any regard to Purcelli and Gray, who were employees of Sparkling Clean. In fact, Mr. Purcelli was the owner of Sparkling Clean as a DBA. There were two broad theories which the pleadings and the evidence justified. Number one, the obligation to exercise ordinary care in its retained control under Section 414. And secondly, vicarious liability for Purcelli and Gray because they had the right to direct and control the details, method, manner of their work. That being the case, the way the charge was submitted, the jury had no clue, literally, as to what to do with respect to Purcelli and Gray. The Purcelli and Gray were just out there without any clue as to whether or not they were, what their relationship to the charge was or what the parties were. We believe that by failing to submit that, we were deprived of the opportunity to have submitted to the jury and submitted to this court the negligence and causative responsibility of Purcelli and Gray, who the evidence showed had heavy responsibility for what happened in this case. The same is true with respect to the instruction, with respect to which was offered once the court determined it was submitting the case the way it was. That instruction would have been necessary to tell the jury, you may consider that because the control existed, which was already submitted in instruction, that because there was control, they became the employees of the other party, which otherwise the jury would never know that they could link up the conduct of Purcelli and Gray in answering the general submission with respect to the submission for Thomas S. Byrne. We believe the case should be reversed and remanded for a new trial on all issues, and that concludes our opening argument, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wallach. Mr. Knopf.
May it please the court, counsel. This case seems to have complicated issues, but the issues really aren't that complicated. When you boil it down and look at the facts and ask yourself whether or not one question can be answered in the affirmative. And that question is, did the appellant invite the error about which he complains? Essentially, they have three issues, and they're all intertwined. The issues are, appellant was a borrowed servant. Thomas S. Byrne was a non-subscriber to workers' compensation, so that it was not entitled to comparative or contributory negligence, proportionate responsibility in the jury charge. The jury charge contained reference to appellant's negligence. The jury returned a verdict of 75% against appellant, 25% against Thomas S. Byrne, and therefore that charge was error. But the question is whether or not they invited that error. We don't get to the borrowed servant issues. We don't get to notice issues. We don't get to law of the case issues if we answer the question, did they invite error? And in this case, they invited error. So I'm going to address that issue first and then come back to the issues of notice, pleadings, and et cetera. Our brief sets forth in more detail, but...
Your contention is that by submitting a proposed charge pre-trial, before the trial even started, they waived error or invited error?
No. It's actually, that's one aspect of it, but the second aspect of it was at the charge conference, Mr. Wallach, after the court said, we are going to only submit issues, questions one and two, as to De Leon and Byrne, Mr. Wallach stood up and said to the court, he re-urged his initial jury charge and said on page 266 of the reporter record 10, which is also appendix 7 to their brief, the plaintiff objects to question number one because the court has failed to include plaintiff's requested issue. Then he went on to say, plaintiff's requested question number one is, did the negligence, if any, of those named below approximately cause the injury in question? Answer yes or no for each. And he listed Thomas S. Byrne, Jimmy Pursley, Sean Gray, and himself, Gerardo De Leon. The court, at that time, overruled the objection. 5 pages later, Mr. Wallet came back and said, another reason why that would be error is because there's a workers' comp bar. The labor code forbids any comparative negligence of my client. After he's already submitted the negligence of his client, both on February 11, 2013, when he originally submitted the charge, and on February 25, 2013, at the charge conference. So that's where I'm saying that they invited the error. He asked the court to submit his client's own negligence as a proportionate responsibility. They have not provided any statutory or case law reference that would support the inclusion of Mr. Pursley or Mr. Gray on the jury charge. As the court is well aware, the CPRC 33.003 says that only a claimant, a defendant, a third responsible third party, or a settling defendant may be included on the jury charge. Mr. Pursley and Mr. Gray were not sued directly by the plaintiffs. In fact, they were sued originally, but right before De Leon won, they non-suited them. There's been no issue with them claiming that Pursley and Gray were settling defendants, responsible third parties, or cross-claimants.
But Sparkling Clean was still in the lawsuit, correct?
No, ma'am. The only people that were still in the lawsuit were Unique Staffing, which was the statutory staff leasing company that had some relationship to Sparkling Clean. We had a contract with Sparkling Clean. Sparkling Clean had a contract with Unique Staffing. Unique Staffing provided employees such as Mr. De Leon to Sparkling Clean to work on the job site.
Okay, I'd like to talk about the pleadings a little bit because I have those before me, and their paragraph 5 says negligence of Bernie or Byrne, however you pronounce that. And it looks to me like they have specifically pleaded negligence based on vicarious liability, even though not using those words. I mean, those facts in those first two paragraphs of the pleading, and I'm on
page 4?
clerk's record, it's page nine.
Of the third amended petition?
Page three. Page three of the petition, page nine of the clerk's record. What did you think that they were pleading there when they pled that Byrne had the right of control over Sparkling Clean and its employees, as well as the manner and means by which it was to perform its work, and then furthermore, those next two paragraphs?
All of those paragraphs go to basically what the court held in De Leon 1, which was we had a contractual right of control. I mean, the case law is replete with, there's probably thousands of
but
cases.
But the reason that you had, but a contractual right of control, all that that means is that an independent contractor, typically a general contractor has no liability for the negligence of an independent contractor absent a right of control. So what did the right of control accomplish if it didn't provide some basis for vicarious liability or for borrowed servant status?
I have not found any case law that says that you can implicitly state by saying right of control that that equals borrowed servant and vicarious liability and master servant
issues. Then what did it do? What did it do then?
Well, I was going to say, a reasonable attorney reading all of these, reading the pleadings, would look at the entirety of the document. And the entirety of the document, they used the term vicarious liability as to Unique Staffing. They didn't use the term vicarious liability as to Thomas S. Byrne.
No, they used right of control and the manner and means by which it was to perform its work.
Which was the holding of this court. The holding of the court was that at our sole discretion, it was discretionary for us to utilize the right of control, we had the contractual right of control of the means and methods and details of the work related to certain aspects. And that's when you read that and then you read the next paragraph.
So when you have that right of control, do you not agree that you have a duty to exercise that right of control non-negligently?
Would have a duty to exercise a right of control non-negligently.
Okay, so isn't that what was pleaded here?
I think what I understand in a plead, if we look at the breakdown, is that we didn't exercise our right of control. They say that we failed to provide reasonably safe detail, failed to control the details of the work at issue. So they're saying that we didn't exercise the contractual right of control that the court has said that we had. So, I mean, when we look at 1 through 18 on pages 4 and 5 of the Third Amendment petition, for instance, they say we violated the contractually assumed and non-delegable duties it owed the plaintiff by, for instance, one, failing to provide additional workers. That was one of the findings that this court said, that the contract allowed them to provide for additional workers. Two, failing to properly supervise the contractor in the use of that aerial boom lift. The court said that that was something that they were contractually obligated to do under 8.01 of the contract. And then going down, so when we look at everything in context, the discussion of right of control, without more, without a statement of vicarious liability, master servant, or any other type of employer doctrine, would lead a reasonable attorney to believe that all he's doing is tracking this court's holding.
The failure to perform a duty be negligence just as the failure to perform a duty properly would be negligent?
It would be based on the pleadings. Yes, Your Honor.
You just said they pled that you failed to perform that right of control at all.
That's one of their pleadings. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So that would be an allegation of negligence, would it not?
Yes. And I don't dispute that they were claiming that we're negligent. I do dispute that they were claiming that there's a master servant or any other type of doctrine that applies.
So you agree that they pled that you were vicariously liable for negligence?
No. Maybe I misunderstood your question. I'm saying that they claimed that we were negligent. We were negligent for not complying with the court's, with the contractual requirement that we follow the contractual right of control. That's different than them saying that we were vicariously liable for the acts or omissions of personally Sparkling Clean or Mr. Gray. It's also different than them saying that it's a borrowed servant issue.
But I don't think that is what they're saying. They're saying that you, that the negligence was specifically limited to the right of control, to the activities that this court previously found you had a right to exercise control over. They're not saying all vicarious liability for Mr. Pursley or all vicarious liability. They're limiting their negligence allegations to the activities that this court previously held there was a right of contractual right of control over.
That's not the way that I read it, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And with regard to the issues of vicarious liability, et cetera, the case law, the JTM v. Morris case, and all the other cases they did cite to, and each one of those, for instance, it was specifically pleaded. For instance, in JTM v. Morris, the court, Justice Walker wrote that Morris contended Largent was its JTM statutory, actual, constructive, or borrowed employee, and then went on to discuss borrowed servant doctrines and the other doctrines. I don't dispute that there is a doctrine called the borrowed servant doctrine of vicarious liability and all of the case law that he cited, that is the case law. I dispute that that's applicable here and that we had notice of any of those items. He stated in his jury charge, he never put in borrowed servant at the time they were submitted on February 11th or on February 25th until after the court had already ruled. Then he came back, had a revelation that, oh, this might be a labor code issue, and I'd like to have a borrowed servant instruction. The court overruled that that objection. And in this case, the issue is, did we have notice? And I would submit that based on these pleadings, the fact that he pleaded vicarious liability and employer-employee status, et cetera, as to unique staffing, but four paragraphs before didn't plead the same thing as to us as insufficient notice. There are thousands of cases where a person claims that a general contractor, a subcontractor claims that a general contractor has the right of control over their over them and is liable for their injuries, but I couldn't find none that said that means implicitly that borrowed servant or master servant issues are triggered. And that's the problem here. You know, based on a reasonable attorney standard, a reasonable attorney would look at this and say, they're just trying to say we have the right of control over these details and that his injury flowed from that, but not that we had some kind of a worker employee-employer relationship.
Well, the right of control goes to the heart of duty. And if you have a right of control, you have a duty. And so that duty necessarily has to flow to someone. And in this case, the allegation is that the duty flowed to Mr. De Leon through Sparkling Cleaning. And so my point is a right of control and a finding of a right of control means that there's a duty to someone. And so I don't think that you can say that it's just a contractual right of control, but that as a result of it, there's not a duty to anyone. I mean, how could that be?
Well, I mean, the trial court submitted an instruction on the whole right of control issue, so that was before the jury. What I'm saying is
there was no way for the jury to apply that right of control, because your position is basically that the negligence that was submitted to the jury is the independent negligence of Byrne. The independent negligence of Byrne through direct liability, not through any contractual right of control over anyone else. Correct?
The instruction was based on this court's holding. And that was properly before the jury.
I'm asking you, what negligence of Byrne do you think was submitted to the jury?
Across the board, everything. Everything he's listed in his pleadings, essentially, or in his brief, essentially that Byrne had the right to say how many employees were out there for Sparkling Clean, didn't ensure that many employees were out there. Mr. De Leon, there were only two people on the site at the time that he was injured. I mean, those are all things that they have pleaded and brought forth in the brief as well. But as far as saying that we are vicariously liable, that there's some kind of an employer-employee because the court found contractual right of control, that just establishes that duty prong of it. But it doesn't establish any type of a master-service relationship. And there was no pleading as to master-service. And we have to base everything on the pleadings and the evidence, and they didn't bring forth any of that. And then we have the workers' comp issue. They've never pleaded anything about workers' comp. There's no labor code pleadings in the before the trial court. To say that we should have specially accepted to a negative that we weren't even aware of is an unduly burdensome on any type of a defendant. And so the fact that there was no pleading of workers' comp, no vicarious liability and other pleadings, and the fact that they invited the error by including himself on the jury charge are all reasons why this court should affirm the lower
Judge,
court.
Judge, I have a question. I know it's time's out, but
go ahead, please.
Mr. Moffitt, this case is rather remarkable to me in that it's an example of a case that's been litigated twice. It's the second time in this court it's litigated below twice on summary judgment and then on a trial. And upon the idea that we're to try cases based upon a good, clear honing down of issues based on special exceptions or based on pleading presentations to the trial court so that the trial court can get a good feel for what issues are actually involved within the fact situation of that supports the pleadings of the plaintiff or the initiating party. So where in this record is there any indication that Byrne objected by exception or any other means to the pleadings of the plaintiff in the second trial?
There are none, Your Honor.
So you made no objection or made no exception or nor called to the court's attention in the trial court that there was not an issue of the vicarious liability because of your interpretation of the holdings in this court in what we're calling DeLeon 1.
As far as a special exception, no, but we did make the objection to the trial court in volume 10 of the reporter's record, and that was sustained by the trial. Our objection was sustained by the trial court. And that's
kind of talking about it in the charge conference?
Yes, sir. There was no pleading for us to make the objection to, and when a reasonable attorney reviews that, how do I make a special exception to something that there's no notice of?
Guess what I'm having a little trouble with is reasonable attorney argument whenever what we've had is a extensive addressing of the issues of contractual control with a determination made by this court that became the law of the case as to Byrne having contractual control. And then after that, the second trial is based upon that underpinning and going forward from there with attempting to allocate responsibility in terms of negligent conduct, and it's rather incredulous to me that there was never any discussion of these very issues that are briefed extensively in your briefing here in the second appeal as to barred servant, parties responsible, the issues dealing with vicarious liability. Those appear to have only been discussed by the attorneys in the charge conference and with somewhat conflicting positions, but certainly the charge conference is not required to be the model of consistency. You're going through about what's happening before and what the trial court might have said and what even different drafts of questions and many things that are not always just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in step with consistency. And so I'm having a little difficulty feeling like there might have been a whole lot of, well, you didn't do that, so I'm not going to do this because I might then be tipping my hand to you that you didn't do that.
There's no evidence of that before the court. All I can say is if they had used the term vicarious liability like they did against Unique Staffing in the same pleading against Thomas S. Byrne, there would have been a special exception. At the end of the day, though, it all comes down to the fact that we can't special accept to something that we can't reasonably know, there's no notice of. There has to be pleadings and evidence, and there was no pleading.
And it's your position before this court that after DeLeon 1 and all of the discussion in that case and the record in that case as to the responsibilities that are that the plaintiff, the complaining party, was attempting to put on Byrne, that you didn't know that they might have been talking about vicarious liability.
That's correct. With regard to right of control. The right of control is an issue that's on, in almost every construction case like this.
I understand. Thank you for your argument, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. Is that all? Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Wallach?
Yes, Your Honor.
I do find it interesting that the defendant Byrne moved for summary judgment on our vicarious liability claim that they now say that they didn't have any knowledge of, which is in the record, as well as the fact they respond to our claim for vicarious liability on a motion for summary judgment, which now they now claim to seem to have not any understanding of, based upon the pleadings. Well, it's their motions for summary judgments, they're in the responses. So that issue was not new at the trial court level when we went to trial. The when someone pleads that another party has the right to direct and control the means, methods, and manner in which someone else does their work, that clearly brings into the issue the concepts of vicarious liability, of master-servant, borrowed-servant, all within this context. And an ordinary prudent lawyer reading those facts, especially when they're saying the party who's charged with control has the burden to provide a safe place to work, they're alleging employment, they're alleging master-servant. It may not be crystal clear, but it is absolutely there. And if they have any questions, file special exceptions, get it straightened out with the trial court so that when we go to trial, we can have the issues in front of us. On the issue of invited error, we've cited three Supreme Court cases and one El Paso Court of Appeals case, which basically say that if you make your objections known during the charge conference, before the charge goes to the jury, that is not invited error. And we don't believe this is invited error. It may not be the model of consistency when you're going back and forth at a charge conference, but the objections were made well before the case went to the jury, so that is not invited error. The issue of non-subscriber, the exclusive remedy defense is that. It is a defense. It is the burden upon the party claiming that defense to plead it, to prove it, and to submit it. The defendant did not do any of that in this case. With respect to...
Mr. Wallach?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is there any evidence in the record of the existence of the fact that Byrne was a subscribing employer?
We answer that two ways. First off, with respect to the record that we're required to look at after a trial on the merits, which is the trial record, there is none. And if the opposing counsel has gone into some other portions of the record and tried to scavenge pieces of information, which they say shows that, we addressed that in our appellant's reply brief, and we don't believe that that's, number one, proper consideration, or number two, that it shows anything which they contend it shows. With respect to the submission of Purcelli and Gray in the court's charge, they say, well, because we're not a defendant, not a responsible third party, not a settling defendant, that they shouldn't be submitted. What we're talking about here is how to submit Thomas S. Byrne. And it's just like a situation, for like the Pilgrim's Pride case that we cited in the brief, where a party has two potential means of liability. Number one, their own direct liability, and second, vicarious liability for somebody else's conduct. You have to submit them separately if the issue of vicarious liability is at issue, which they made the issue of vicarious liability at issue throughout the entire case. So the way to submit that, number one, is to separate them out in the charge. You're not submitting them per se, you're submitting the defendant's liability for them, so therefore the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is not in a, is not opposite to that submission. And finally, with respect to the issue of non-subscriber, I touched on that. There's no pleading proof or anything else. Looking back at the Brin case, which we cited in our brief, says the statutes and rules contemplate primarily the allegations of the facts out of which the rights of plaintiff have grown and do not require the presentation of the theory or theories of law applicable to the facts alleged or that the allegations of fact be fitted into a form or forms of action. We look to the substance of the pleading and what can reasonably be inferred to an ordinarily prudent lawyer, and we believe, Your Honor, that this case should be reversed and remanded for a new trial.
Counsel, thank you very much for your briefing and your argument. It's been very helpful to the court. We appreciate your time here today. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.